Welcome to episode 62 of Published. Today we're doing a special episode for you. Our in-house publishing consultant, David Endres, has compiled some of the most common questions we get from authors. So today he's interviewing me. We'll talk about a range of topics in today's episode and attempt to best answer your most burning publishing questions.
Welcome to Published, a podcast by Greenleaf Book Group, where we'll discuss the ins and outs of the publishing industry, from writing a book and finding the right publisher, to gearing up for a book launch. And now, here's your host, Greenleaf Book Group CEO, Tanya Hall.
Welcome back to Published. This episode is unique in that you'll be hearing from me today, and you'll also be introduced to David, one of our in-house publishing consultants who's come out from behind his desk to chat with me about some of the common questions he gets from authors. These questions will span from how do I protect my manuscript to how do I become a bestseller. So if these are things you've maybe asked before, be sure to stay tuned. And if you like this episode, please leave a comment and send us more questions. If we get enough responses, we'll probably do another one of these in the future. And for now, let's get into the interview.
Hi, I'm David Endres. I am a full-time in-house consultant with Greenleaf Book Group. I have been with Greenleaf for about 2.5 years. And what I do is help authors strategize their book projects from the early stages through the entire process up to and including publication date and beyond. Tanya, hello and welcome to Published. So as we always do, can you start by just telling us a little bit about yourself and what you do here at Greenleaf Book Group?
Certainly. Well, in addition to hosting this podcast, I'm the CEO of Greenleaf Book Group, and I've been here for 18 years. So I've kind of hopscotched around the company quite a bit before landing in the CEO role, and I've therefore built a wealth of experience in everything from distribution to marketing. I will say a moderate level of editorial and design knowledge, although that is not my forte, and I try not to interfere in those areas too much, but just a lot of general publishing knowledge. And prior to that, I worked in broadcast TV, so have been a media person my entire career.
Brilliant. So first question, and this is one that we get quite a bit when speaking with authors, is they are worried about their page count. Is my book too long? Is my book too short? What kind of advice would you give those authors?
Yeah, this is a common one. And my advice initially will be related to, let's call it a traditionally distributed book, right? So something that is intended to go into brick and mortar retail, as we call it, because that's when this really becomes important for merchandising reasons. So the magic number, to give you the short answer to your question, is 60,000 words, give or take. That's going to give us a book that is 200 pages, give or take, with a standard 6-inch by 9-inch, what we call trim size. And the reason we want to have at least that many pages is because, of course, when you go into a Barnes & Noble or even a library or an airport, usually the books are spine out and we need some real estate for that book to be noticed. So if it's any smaller than 200 pages, it starts to really shrink the dimensions of the spine to where the book literally gets lost on the shelf, and we don't want that. Of course, at the same time, nobody wants to read a book that really should be an article and has been fluffed up to no end to meet 60,000 words. And for that reason, designers can do some amazing things. If we're sort of short on words, they can play with a little smaller trim size, which in turn kind of beefs up the spine, or we can do fun things with the layout to introduce some graphic elements that can, again, just give us a little bit more room to play with as we're working to get to that optimal dimension for merchandising purposes. But as is always the case in publishing, it's kind of a, it depends question, because there are certainly books, David, I know that you personally are very familiar with one that we've recently done that's probably double that, if not more. So we have books that are way more than 60,000 words, and we have books that are less. So it really, above all, kind of depends on what does the content demand. And then if we're looking at a print-on-demand publishing model, this doesn't really matter as much. We actually have a lot more leeway because we don't have to deal with things like merchandising or what the retail buyers are looking at when they're working off of their modeling systems. So that's another reason why we kind of try to target that 200-page length, because retail buyers have systems that say this type of book, when it is this length and this price point, sells this number of units. So it gives them some knowledge to make more informed purchases. And when we move away from that, we start to see our results, I would say, waver as we're trying to get books into retail. But that, none of that matters when you're doing print on demand and the book is intended for sale online. So we can be a lot more flexible on that front.
Yeah, there's definitely a sweet spot, arguably, in that sense. Yeah, and certainly a minimum, even with print on demand, with POD, and no maximum. But I guess when we hit a certain point, then the conversation becomes, well, should this be two books, possibly?
Exactly, because we have to think about reader expectations too, right? We all have some assumptions about the length of a book. And I think, you know, you can look at something and think like, sheesh, that book is tiny, there's nothing to it. Or you might think that's a relief. Or you might look at something that's, you know, 600 pages and think, oh my gosh, I don't know if I can get through it. So we also have to think about the reader experience when we're considering length.
I know that a lot of authors with whom I speak have multiple books in their queue that they'd like to publish. This happens quite often. What would you say to an author who's undecided on which to go with first, if they're in different genres, for example, or they're on different topics?
That is a common one, and especially when those genres are sort of parallel to each other, or the content can be complementary. We see this in business and self-help quite often. And I would say think long and hard about the audience you're trying to reach. And there may be more than one, but what is the primary audience you're trying to reach? And then which genre are they in? Also, where's your platform? So if you're a business leader, and we've seen this before, we have business leaders who are maybe experts in strategy, and they say, well, I feel passionately that the ideas in strategy can be brought to the self-help readers. And it's a little bit of a difficult leap to make, because that business leader's platform is in the business community. That's where all of the people who are eager to read that person's content are. That's where probably most of their community, if you will, is centered, in this business community. So it's sometimes difficult to make a leap into a genre where you just don't have any brand, really. So think about that. You know, where is your support? And if that circle of support aligns with a certain area of content that best serves your audience, that's the magic formula.
Got it. Yeah, very insightful. Another thing that I hear from time to time too, and this goes down to the fact that, you know, books are the babies of the authors. They're very, very, fairly protective of them. And sometimes they'll ask, well, you know, is it dangerous to submit my book to a publisher? Will somebody steal it? How do you protect it? What do you usually say to those authors?
I understand where the concern is coming from, but really the risk is quite low. That being said, most publishers are used to hearing this concern, and a decent publisher will readily give you an NDA, a non-disclosure agreement, so that you can feel protected on the front end as your book goes through these review processes. But the reason I say it's fairly low risk is publishers are publishers. Publishers are not writers. So for the publisher to make any use of the work that they might allegedly steal, they'd have to be passing it to another author, and that author is not you. They don't have your experience that led to the voice that comes through in the book, and things would sort of fall apart in the promotional period because there wouldn't be any alignment between the original author and then this, whoever this new person is that's representing it. So I think probably what is more common is that an idea will be, let's say, iterated upon in such a way that someone who submitted a manuscript to a publisher says, that's awfully close to what I submitted. And it's not an exact copy, but they may be worried that they have something so fresh that someone else is going to run off with this fresh idea. And to that extent, I would say then you need to work to really make sure that your unique voice and whatever it is that makes you the person to write this book shines through in that manuscript. And then really it's pretty difficult for someone else to come in and hijack it. Now, once you've got the work written, you just by virtue of writing it, have copyright protection. But for that to be enforceable and for you to have legal remedy, if some infraction were to occur, you need to have your copyright registered with the Copyright Office. So quite often your publisher will take care of that for you. It's certainly worth making sure that somewhere in your publishing agreement, that element is buttoned up so that you have that protection. But yes, it's, you have a copyright by virtue of just writing the book, but you need to register it for it to really be enforceable. And I will also add this notion of a poor man's copyright, where you drop your manuscript in the mail to yourself, is only going to cost you some postage. You're not going to get anything out of it. That is a myth. You cannot actually copyright your book that way.
Good to know. Yeah. All very helpful. You know, another thing that comes up a lot when I'm talking to authors is, because we are a hybrid publisher, I'm asked what that actually means. And there certainly seems to be a bit of confusion in the industry of the differences between the different publishing options, the different verticals that an author can pick to bring their book to the retail market. So could you just kind of let us know sort of the difference between self-publishing, vanity presses, hybrid, and the traditional model?
Yes. And like you said, there is a lot of confusion around these terms, partly because there are different iterations of the hybrid publishing model. And the word itself really only has started to sort of regularly be used in the last 10 years or so. So the way that I frame it is, we are literally a hybrid between self-publishing and traditional publishing, in that, like the self-publishing side of things, our authors invest in the production of their work. They maintain creative control and their intellectual property rights. But drawing from the traditional side, we bring a team of experts to the table, and we bring distribution muscle on par with the traditional publishing houses. So the difference between hybrid publishing and self-publishing, in my mind, is quality and distribution. Hybrid publishers vet, and they have a selective process by which they screen incoming material because they have quality standards. Why do they have quality standards? Because they have to sell the book. And if you have a reputation of bringing on a whole bunch of books that are garbage, you very quickly lose your selling power. So Greenleaf Book Group is unique in that we are a publisher and a distributor. We keep distribution in-house. But other hybrid publishers have distribution. They just use third parties, and that's fine. As long as there is a proactive sales force championing the book, you know, you can say it's being distributed. So I will also add that IBPA, the Independent Book Publishers Association, actually has a wonderful list of criteria by which to qualify a hybrid publisher. So if you're looking at a potential deal with a hybrid publisher and you're wondering, like, are they actually a hybrid publisher? It's a very good idea to just check out that list from IBPA and ask the questions, see if they meet those standards, and that should give you a pretty good feel. As far as the other areas that you described, a vanity press would be like Author House or any of those Author Solution family publishing companies, or Lulu, where you literally can just upload a manuscript and click some buttons and it's published. So it's called vanity because they're appealing to an author's vanity, their ego, to just publish whatever. There is no vetting. There is no real expectation to sell it into the retail market. So there's no screening for quality. And typically those books sell very few copies because of that. And generally, you want to stay away from vanity publishing. There are some really crooked vanity publishers who will even charge the author for publishing services and retain some rights, which should never happen. If you're paying for services, the flip side of that is you retain some rights. So be careful with vanity publishers. There's a great website called Writer Beware, where you can research if you are starting to suspect that maybe that's what you're dealing with. And then the self-publishing side, I would actually say that can be the most gray, because you can start with a true self-publishing approach where you are the general contractor and you are hiring the designer and the editors and probably the marketing support, and you are tackling distribution on your own. But that's probably where you're going to hit a wall, because most retail accounts won't deal with an author who just has the one-off book. So at that point, you may turn into a self-publisher who is working with a distributor, in which case, all that means is you're sort of like your own independent publishing company. So David, I would invite you to add to that because I feel like it was clear as mud.
No, that makes sense. And actually, furthermore, touching on just the sheer number of different options that authors have nowadays, which is a wonderful thing, right? That wasn't maybe the case 20, 30, 40 years ago. But nowadays, you get a lot more people who want to write a book and publish it because they can. And that being said, another common question that comes up is, just by virtue of how flooded the market is, they want to know, well, how do I get a publisher to notice my book? So what do you look for as a publisher in a book for a debut author, and what sort of rings the bells, as it were?
Yeah, I think any publisher worth their salt is going to say, of course, we're looking for quality content supported by an author who we legitimately believe is going to do their part in promoting the book. I often tell people that the best books that we have published here at Greenleaf are not our top-selling books, and that may get me into trouble, but the point is that you can have a really amazing book, and if the author doesn't do their part to promote it, it's not going to be a strong seller. We really need the author to come to the table and understand the commitment that's involved in getting out there and selling the book. So quality content, content that's differentiated, is obviously super appealing. There's just so much competition in publishing, with thousands of books being published every day, that if something comes along and it makes people say, oh, that's a different take on it, or that's maybe something a little controversial even, those are the types of things that make people notice when the book comes out, and therefore it's going to probably have a little stronger selling power for us. And then I would also say that we're looking for authors who work well within our business model, which does require collaboration. We need their input on a lot of creative decisions. We need their sign off on things. And at the same time, we expect them to respect that we are experts in this, having done it for 25 years. And we have to turn around and sell the book into the retail market. So, you know, our suggestions are coming from that angle. And we're often in a situation where we will have to find a middle of the road approach to something for that reason. So we may have an author, for instance, who insists on a certain color palette for the cover because it is then in line with their company branding. And so we say, okay, we can work on that or with that and come up with something that's also compelling for the market that we have to serve. So those compromises can be made if there is the right spirit behind those conversations. But just in terms of author expectations, if somebody comes in with a book and they're expecting to sell hundreds of millions of copies and win a Pulitzer Prize, you know, we're probably going to have a talk about expectations, because it's not that we don't want that too. We would love that. But history says that's potentially a long shot. And ultimately, we don't want a disappointed author.
Sure. Yeah. It's a business, you know, much like music, movies, or other kinds of art. Book publishing is, though, an art. It's a business, you know. So, and that being said, how do you go about figuring out cover prices for books?
Mm. Ooh. Cover prices, well, like everything in the world right now, they're going up because paper prices are going up. But in general, I would say you could compare it to the process that a realtor would use when coming up with the price for a house that they're going to sell. So they look at comparable homes that have recently sold in the area, and that's usually how they come up with a range. We do the same thing. We look at comparable books that are in an author's genre that have a similar page count, that are the same binding, you know, whether that's hardcover, paperback, and are fairly recent. And then we'll get a sampling of what those price ranges are and present that range to the author. So it might be like, okay, we're seeing we could do $26.95 to $29.95, and we'd be fine anywhere in that range. Now, if you are a first-time author, we're going to gently nudge you towards the $26.95 end, simply because it increases your chances of buyers taking a chance on the book. And I mean both the retail buyers at the corporate level who make the decisions about what goes into the store, and also readers, right? So if they don't know you and they haven't read your work before, they may be put off by a price point that's too high. It's just too much of a risk for them to take. So very often you can start at that lower end of the range, and then as you move into new editions and even additional printings, you can raise the price once demand warrants. So it's very much supply and demand.
And it's a delicate balance between the two. Switching gears here, and this is a big one for you, and a question that I field on a regular basis is, how do I become a bestseller? What does it take?
Yes. This question. Let me answer that in two ways. First of all, I used to sort of turn my nose up at the notion of working to become an Amazon bestseller because, in fact, even in my book, Ideas, Influence, and Income, I think I still take that position. So it's probably time for me to do a new edition because I've been converted. For it to be an Amazon bestseller, you really have to push a certain velocity of sales within a 1 hour period. And you may think, as I did back in the day, like, who cares? Who cares if you're an Amazon bestseller when especially people in the industry know it can be so easily gained? Well, the answer is the search engine behind Amazon cares. So its algorithm takes into consideration many things, including visits to a page and clicks and reviews when determining what to surface to a user when they search for certain terms. It's a giant search engine, right, Amazon? So we want to make sure that we increase our author's chances of turning up high in those search results, and achieving that bestseller strategy is one element that contributes to that. So for that reason, yes, I'm now a supporter of the Amazon bestseller campaigns, and they can be very important to search. And so what is required, as I said earlier, it's really a matter of looking at your network and figuring out who in your network you can mobilize to buy the book all within a 1 hour period. There are strategists who do this. We do it in-house at Greenleaf too for our authors to make sure that we've got all those moving parts buttoned up for them. And they can usually then achieve that bestseller status in a few categories if done well. And then, of course, there's the how do I become a New York Times or Wall Street Journal bestseller, even USA Today. The short answer is that is also a measure of velocity of sales, but it's in a 1 week period. Now, each of those publications comes up with their lists in their own unique way. And especially the New York Times is, you know, quite hush hush. Again, there's a whole section about this in my book, but suffice it to say, authors who are able to muster up some pre-orders and really rally a lot of support, usually in the first week or so of their book's launch, can be well positioned to hit one of those lists. How many books does it take? It depends on when your book is coming out, what kind of competition, of course, since it is a ranking. If there's a whole bunch of books that are selling like Harry Potter type numbers, you may be in trouble. But there are certain times of the year when you have better chances because there aren't historically the big books that come out, let's say, in fall and spring. So again, there are strategists in our industry who work on these types of things. And it's something that really takes a lot of preparation and advanced strategy to do right. But certainly we've got, I believe, over 50 New York Times and Wall Street Journal bestsellers here at Greenleaf, so it can be done.
Yeah, and I'll echo the Amazon bestseller status too, especially with just how many books sell online. And certainly in the year or two during the pandemic when people were shopping online, we've seen that pendulum shift more to, you know, a balanced split between bookstores and Amazon now. But regardless, with 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 brand new books published every single day around the world, the big question is, how do I get my book to be visible? And it's through tweaking Amazon's algorithm, and the bestseller status will help it regardless to get it to be visible, discoverable, and searchable to find people who don't know who a particular author is, but can do so just by poking around online. So,
yeah, that's very true. And I also add, when authors start to sort of dig around on this topic with me, you know, I frequently will turn it back on them to ask why it matters. And so if you're a speaker, yes, having Wall Street Journal, New York Times bestseller behind your name is a huge differentiator and actually can bump up your speaking fees quite a bit because it just makes you stand out from the pack. And it really gives this third party verification, right, of the validity of your ideas. So on the other side, if you're someone who thinks that hitting that list is just going to immediately transfer into sustained sales, I can tell you that doesn't happen. So if all of that effort went into week one, but there was no effort going into sustaining it and continuing to engage and build your platform, after that, those sales are just going to drop off. And people don't really hunt for the next book they want on the bestsellers list, typically. Some people do, but that's not a pattern that you should expect to see.
Got it. Yeah, great advice. Well, Tanya, thank you so much for your insight today. Now, if there are authors out there that have more questions about the writing and publishing process, could you recommend some resources for them to turn to in the meantime?
Of course. And at the risk of sounding self-promotional, I swear to you, everything I know about publishing is in my book. And all of the questions that we talked about today are in there as well. And that's Ideas, Influence, and Income. I will say this podcast is a wealth of information. We've had tons of guests in all different topics that have shared really fascinating insights. So that's a great resource. And then the Learning Center on Greenleaf Book Group's website, on greenleafbookgroup.com, has so much information, and it's organized by categories. So you can deep dive on editorial, marketing, design, audience building, all kinds of stuff. So those are some really strong resources. And then in general, you know, especially for our authors, the team here at Greenleaf, we are all word nerds and publishing geeks, and we always encourage our authors to lean on us to see, you know, if we can help you with whatever's on your mind. And to that end, David, I wonder, since you are one of those people who's getting these questions right and left all day long, what's something that our listeners might benefit from that you are frequently answering?
Yeah, I would say one that we didn't really touch on specifically comes down to timelines, which just as much as the variety in publishing options are varies as greatly. On one hand, an author can self-publish fairly quickly within, it could be weeks, it could be a couple months. At the other end of the spectrum, via the traditional model where there's a lot more gatekeepers involved, from a literary agent through an acquisitions editor all the way up the chain to the actual publisher of any given imprint, it could be anywhere from 2 to 3 years from the start of the process until the book's publication date. And then there's every shade of gray between. Greenleaf tends to publish books within 7 to 12 months. It tends to be on the higher end just by virtue of the buying timeline of our book buyers, who typically will be shopping for titles 6 or 7 months before the book's publication date. That's when they're deciding what books to take, how many copies. But that's a sort of a rough time frame. I think one of the preconceived notions a lot of authors have is that it's a much quicker process. But if done well, if done correctly, it actually takes a bit of time for it to be done. So,
yeah, that's a great point. Book publishing is way more complicated than some people think. When done right.
When done right, indeed.
Yeah. Great. Yeah, David, thanks for letting me be a guest on my own show.
Indeed. Brilliant. Thank you so much, Tanya.
All right. Thank you.
That's it for our episode today. We hope we were able to answer your publishing questions. For notes and resources from today's show, go to greenleafbookgroup.com/episode62. You can also find advice for writing, publishing, and promoting your work in my book, Ideas, Influence, and Income, which you can learn more about at ideasinfluenceandincome.com. If you've enjoyed our show, please rate and review us on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever it is you listen to your podcasts. It means a lot to have your feedback and helps us make sure we're answering your publishing questions. A big thank you to Eleanor Fishborn, who produces the published podcast, and we will be back next month with another new episode.
Thanks for listening to Published. To learn more, please visit greenleafbookgroup.com. And remember to subscribe to this podcast on iTunes.